Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, February 6, 2019. Some church leaders in South Sudan are accusing lawmakers of land grabbing.
This land belonged to Juba State. There was a time they have written us a letter that we have to leave the church immediately. And then we went to the mayor. And then the mayor wrote a letter to the parliament. That place is for the church.
And the UN Secretary General says he's hopeful peace will return to troubled parts of Africa.
And we are totally committed to work together, African Union and the African sub-region organizations, to make sure that the African continent is able to achieve its goal to end conflicts by 2020.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The leaders of a church in Juba are accusing some lawmakers of trying to grab church land close to the National Legislative Assembly. A pastor of the church says unidentified security operatives repeatedly served them with letters ordering them to vacate the land. The head of the Assembly's Committee on Information and Technology says he is aware of the land dispute and believes the matter can be resolved. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
The disputed land measures roughly 300 by 300 meters and located west of the National Legislative Assembly. A water plant run by the Urban Water Corporation occupies part of the land. A signpost labeled Jibek State SPLM Secretariat has been erected on the same piece of land. A pastor at the Christ Church Nakasongola, who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals, says unidentified man who claimed to represent the National Legislative Assembly approached him on Monday advising him to sign a document under which he agrees to vacate the land.
Around 2 o'clock, somebody brought us a letter from the parliament authorizing us that we have to leave the church for before 30 days of this month. So that if we do not leave the church, they will come and demolish the church. They need this place. Then I said, no, the church is for God.
The pastor says this is the fourth time unidentified people have served leaders of Christ Church Nakasongola with letters ordering them to vacate the land. He says the church was built on the land in 1989, and the church holds documents from the State Ministry of Infrastructure and Juba City Council providing the land belongs to the church.
They said this land belonged to the parliament since, but it is not so. This land belonged to Juba State. There was a time they have written us a letter that we have to leave the church immediately. And then we went to the mayor. And then the mayor wrote a letter to the parliament that that place is for the church. So they should not disturb us unless if they have any reason.
In the past, he says some church leaders were detained for refusing to vacate the land. He says church leaders want top government officials to intervene and make sure that clergy are not forced to leave the land.
The church will continue to go forward to see the governor or to see the president for this issue. Because there are other people who want to spoil the name of the government, but the top leaders, they do not know. It is only the ground people who want to provoke people.
Another pastor who spoke on condition of anonymity for safety reasons says some lawmakers began to show interest in the land as soon as South Sudan declared its independence from Sudan in 2011. He says immediately after independence, some parliamentarians began claiming the land for personal business.
We don't know exactly reasons why we have been oppressed to leave the land. The parliamentarians, some individuals like Kenyi, James, previous years, that guy has really harmed us a lot. Some of the sayings when he was talking, they wanted to put, I think, hotel or restaurant. If you're a normal human being, you have to think critically. Who is caring for your life? I think it's God.
James Kenyi, the Deputy Clerk of Parliamentary Affairs, declined to comment on the matter, saying he will only comment once he is formally accused. Paul Yohan Bonju, the head of the National Assembly's Committee on Information and Technology, says the government respects the church. He predicts the land dispute will be sorted out peacefully.
If the church has some documents, and I think it is not a big deal, this government is built on law, there are legal institutions, there are legal channels that this issue should be easily addressed. But I want to tell you that the government from day one respects the church, and as you have seen around the church, there used to be people who are staying there. The government decided to move those people and left the church as it is. Why? Because the government believe that there are Christians who are worshiping there.
Last year, some people in the Muslim community in Juba complained about individuals whom they confiscated their property in Juba Town, Melekeir, and Konyakonya. In June 2018, President Salva Kiir vowed to give back the illegal land grabbed to the South Sudan Islamic Council. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
The European Union says they are seeing some progress in the implementation of the revitalized peace deal. The head of the EU delegation to South Sudan says there are positive changes across the country compared to 12 months ago. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Ambassador Sinet Wells says the EU is encouraged by the progress being made by South Sudan's former warring parties in implementing the peace agreement. Wells tells South Sudan in Focus that several political and security meetings held between the parties gives civilians more confidence that the deal will be fully implemented.
If you look around the country, since September, but maybe even more since November, you've had all sorts of local level agreements, a lot of them between the SSPDF and the IO and sometimes other parties, where they say, okay, we are here in Raja, or we are here, in whichever part of the country, and we will set up an agreement that basically says that, you know, people can move freely, we'll try and increase humanitarian access, and we've seen that this is actually leading to more freedom of movement for civilians and more confidence, of civilians.
But Wells says more consensus must be reached between the parties on implementing some of the security arrangements and on tougher issues like the number of states and their boundaries.
We need more momentum. We need to be moving, I think more quickly through some of the issues. And, you know, I say that knowing that they're really quite difficult, but maybe there needs to be some reflection on some of the on the deadlines, because, you know, we know, for example, on issues around borders and boundaries and on security, we know that the pre-transitional period is supposed to do A, B, and C. We're more or less halfway now through the pre-transitional period, and we are behind schedule. So
Wells is urging peace mediators and the Intergovernmental Authority on Development to ensure that the parties adhere to the deadlines stipulated in the implementation matrix. And as he says, South Sudanese leaders should see implementing the peace agreement as an opportunity to resolve the country's bigger challenges and to move beyond its painful past.
This is a really a historic opportunity. This is the time we must get this right in all of our different capacities, whether we're part of the peace agreement, whether we're supporters of the peace agreement. We all have an opportunity to grasp, this peace agreement and to run with it and to really put an end to, a lot of the tragic events that have happened over the last number of years in South Sudan.
The former Irish ambassador to Sierra Leone and Liberia says the European Union supports the peace agreement and wants to see it succeed. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Still on the revitalized peace deal, the International Organization for Migration is appealing for $122 million this year to support the return of about 1 million South Sudanese people displaced by the conflict. The head of IOM in South Sudan says the funds will be used to provide food and shelter to internally displaced persons and refugees. Dimo Silva Aurelio has the details for VOA from Juba.
IOM chief in South Sudan, John Phillips, says the funds will allow IOM and other aid agencies to provide for the humanitarian needs of the returnees.
That's basically money that's going to allow us to continue providing humanitarian assistance to the most vulnerable people in South Sudan. But it's also going to look at a transition, making sure that if returns happen, they can happen in an orderly fashion, making sure that we empower individuals, families, communities to be more resilient. So we'll be also looking at helping not just internally displaced people, but also host communities, returnees, and in some cases, migrants in this country. So it's an appeal that's going to cover our entire operations for the duration of 2019.
Philip tells South Sudan in Focus, IOM intends to use what he calls a double-pronged approach, meaning helping returning South Sudanese and at the same time empowering host communities. Since the outbreak of conflict in late 2013, South Sudan has faced an ongoing humanitarian crisis. Over these past 5 years, more than 4 million people have fled their homes in search of safety. Nearly 2 million are displaced internally. Philip says the IOM conducted a survey over the last 2 months, which found that IDPs are now willing to voluntarily return to their homes so long as their safety is guaranteed.
IDPs who are currently, for instance, in POCs in Wau or in Bentiu have expressed an interest in returning, providing the security conditions in areas of return are there, and providing enough assistance is provided to make sure that those returns are sustainable.
Philip says IOM is working to make sure that conditions are proper where IDPs are returning and that they have the assistance they need. He says the IOM funds will help both IDPs and the refugees, especially in areas most affected by the conflict. South Sudan has been ranked the worst place in the world to be a humanitarian worker. Nearly 108 workers have been killed since the conflict began. Philip says that has to end.
In South Sudan, a lot of humanitarian workers are arrested or killed. South Sudan is a dangerous country for humanitarian workers to operate in. So the appeal also underlines the need basically to protect humanitarian workers. Whoever the belligerents are must respect humanitarian workers.
Philip says although the intensity of the conflict has decreased since the revised peace deal was signed last year, the country still faces devastating humanitarian financial cost. He says widespread poverty and threats of famine and a lack of livelihood opportunities remain huge challenges across the country. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the UNMISS chief is sounding hopeful about South Sudan's future. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you could relive an age, what age would you like to be?
I would like to go back to my secondary school days because there are other things that I see that I did not do well. I was very childish.
I would say that the age between 20 and 22nd. By that time, I think I was very more handsome than today, and I was energetic than today.
That's 18, because it's the time I enjoyed most. I got to know more about life, what the world is all about.
I would like to be at the age of 17, because at that time, we go out. We go out for hunting, playing football, or a lot of entertaining activities.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The head of the United Nations mission in South Sudan says he is hopeful the country's transitional government will succeed. David Scherer says following the signing of the revitalized peace agreement in September last year, conditions across the country have improved. Carol Van Damme reports for VOA from Washington.
UNMISS boss David Shearer said on Tuesday that the government has control of more territory and there's an enormous push by the people of South Sudan for real change.
And I don't think either side can turn their back on that. And together with the way that the peace negotiations were conducted, it brought both sides together and they were able to agree on the basic framework for going forward. Now, there are some tricky issues still to be resolved And no peace agreement is ever perfect. But it's an agreement that is there that we feel offers the best chance in a long while for moving South Sudan in the right direction.
He made the comments at United Nations headquarters in New York. Shearer also said that while the UN is very mindful of the pitfalls that lie ahead, it is cautiously optimistic that both sides are, in his words, committed to going down that path, and if that happens, it'll make an enormous change to South Sudan. Warring factions and the government of President Salva Kiir last year signed a new deal. Under the agreement, former Vice President Riek Machar, who led one of the largest rebel groups, expects to return home later this year and take part in the transitional government. The UN mission chief paints an optimistic picture of the current state of security in the country. He said civilian casualties have greatly diminished in recent months.
In the last 4 months since the signing of the agreement, there's been a very significant decline in civilian casualties as a result of political violence. There has been a uptick in the amount of casualties with regard to cattle rustling, raiding, that sort of thing. It would be in the low hundreds, I would say.
Some fighting continues in parts of the Equatoria region, he said, but casualties are in the twos and threes, not in the hundreds. And where peacekeepers patrol, such as around protection of civilian sites, Shearer says violence is almost non-existent.
Very low numbers. In the POCs, it's virtually nothing. If there's anything, it'll be criminal rather than anything else. And throughout the rest of the country, peace agreement and the ceasefire has largely held.
Shearer noted that some people have concerns about security when Machar returns. He's expected to come back in May when the pre-transitional government is supposed to wind down and make way for the transitional government of national unity. He points out that a combined pre-transitional committee, as outlined in the revitalized deal, will make decisions about security arrangements.
We believe that it's in the best interest of the peace agreement that the parties themselves decide how they want to handle those those security arrangements. If they can handle them themselves, that is an enormous confidence step to being able to get things moving. That does not involve the UN.
Shearer said so far the UN has not been approached by any side regarding security for Machar's return. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres travels to Addis Ababa this week for the African Union Summit. He sat down with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir ahead of his trip and said cooperation between the UN and the African Union has substantially improved, and expressed optimism that the continent is making progress on some of its biggest challenges.
Africa is facing no shortage of conflicts or challenges, either man-made or natural. But UN Chief Guterres believes reinvigorated cooperation between the world body and African Union can play a significant role in helping the continent surmount them.
Our own objective is to make Africa overcome its difficulties, to make Africa a continent of hope, to make Africa a continent of future, to make Africa a pillar of the world in which we live, not seen as a problem, but seen as an opportunity.
One recent challenge was the presidential election in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The results were disputed, and the man many believe came in a distant second was inaugurated as president. But the handover of power went off peacefully in that country for the first time in 60 years. Guterres says all parties in the DRC should now work to move the country forward.
But we consider that what's important now, after the elections with the new government, is to create the conditions for inclusive dialogue among all parties and to make sure that we have a transition of power that allows for the country to move ahead.
Across the continent, Guterres said the United Nations is committed to a surge in diplomacy for peace to complement the AU's push to end conflict on the continent by 2020. He noted progress implementing the peace deal between rivals Salva Kiir and Riek Machar in South Sudan, and this week's agreement between the government of the Central African Republic and several armed groups. He also welcomed the recent reconciliation between Ethiopia and Eritrea as an important example of the potential of diplomacy.
We see in many other areas movement in the right direction, and we are totally committed to work together, African Union and the African sub-regional organizations, to support this wind of hope to make sure that the African continent is able to achieve its goal to end conflicts by 2020.
When the UN chief travels to Addis Ababa this week, he will be taking a message of the UN's commitment to Africa's peace, stability, and development. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Today marks the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. The United Nations is calling for action to eliminate the procedure by 2030. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN estimates at least 200 million girls and women alive today have been subjected to female genital mutilation, a procedure that partially or totally removes female genital organs. The UN says every year more than 3 million girls between infancy and age 15 are at risk of being subjected to the harmful practice. While FGM mainly occurs in 30 countries in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, it is a global problem, with some migrant communities carrying on the traditional practice in Western countries. The World Health Organization says FGM has no medical justification and leads to long-term physical, psychological, and social consequences. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says awareness of the harmful effects of FGM is growing, and progress is being made toward banning it in some communities. He tells VOA that given the rate of population growth in countries where FGM is prevalent, action must be accelerated to reduce the number of girls at risk of undergoing the procedure.
There was an analysis that was done by our colleagues in UNFPA estimating that if female genital mutilation continues to be practiced at current levels, 68 million more girls will be subjected to FGM by 2030.
World leaders overwhelmingly backed the elimination of female genital mutilation by 2030 as one of the UN's sustainable development goals. The UN considers it achievable if nations act now to translate that commitment into action. The UN says public pledges by entire communities to abandon female genital mutilation may be effective in some ways. The world body, however, says such pledges must be paired with comprehensive strategies for breaking down the cultural, traditional, and religious behaviors that allow the practice to persist. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. allies have given a cautious welcome to the announcement of a second summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to be held in Vietnam later this month. The U.S. leader said during his State of Union address Tuesday that peace talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan must be given a chance, and he pledged to pull American troops out of what he called costly wars. Henry Ridgewell reports on global reaction to a speech widely seen as light on foreign policy.
President Donald Trump announced he will meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in late February in the Vietnamese city of Da Nang, the latest milestone in what Trump claimed as a major success of his term in office.
Nuclear testing has stopped, and there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months.
South Korea welcomed the summit announcement, but called for specific and practical actions to be agreed upon. Seoul is taking a cautious approach, says U.S. policy analyst and author James Boyes.
I would imagine that there are many people in South Korea who are concerned at this point that perhaps Donald Trump might continue that withdrawal process and talk about bringing American troops home from the Korean Peninsula in exchange for any nuclear agreement.
To gasps from some in the audience, Trump said America would likely be at war with North Korea had his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton won the presidency in 2016. His claims of success in negotiations with Pyongyang are disputed, says Leslie Vinjamuri, head of the U.S. program at policy group Chatham House.
There's still evidence that they are committed to their nuclear program.
Trump repeated his pledge to bring American troops home from costly wars.
We have spent more than $7 trillion in fighting wars in the Middle East. As a candidate for president, I loudly pledged a new approach. Great nations do not fight endless wars.
He added that Islamic State had been largely defeated in Syria, but there are growing concerns among allies over an American withdrawal from long-running conflicts, says Chatham House's Leslie Vinjamuri.
As to whether you can really rely on the Taliban to deliver on any peace settlement that might be agreed, certainly a lot of concern by women in Afghanistan of what that would mean. And again, he's, you know, same line that he's going to pull America's troops out of Syria, and there's very grave concern there about what the implications of that will be for stability in Syria, for ISIS, the threat from ISIS, whether that will grow.
Separately, Trump criticized Russia's purported violation of a Cold War-era missile treaty that both Washington and Moscow have pulled out of in recent days, and warned that without a new agreement, the U.S. would outspend and out-innovate all others. Again, analyst James Boyes.
It's notable that he was very critical of European leaders, NATO allies, claiming that they've had to be dragged kicking and screaming to pay their share of the defense expenditure, for example, and yet spoke quite warmly of people like President Xi, for example, from China.
Trump was referring to the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty. The U.S. vowed to withdraw from the treaty in 6 months unless Moscow ends what the U.S. calls violations of the landmark 1987 Arms Control Pact. Russian President Vladimir Putin said earlier Moscow will start working on creating new missiles, including hypersonic weapons, and told his ministers not to initiate disarmament talks with Washington. With little new in terms of U.S. foreign policy, the impression from afar is the State of the Union address was aimed at addressing Trump's challenges at home. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song African Tipi Collection by Sam Fan Thomas. We've been listening to Sam Fan Thomas with his song African Tipi Collection. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thank you for allowing us into your homes and vehicles tonight. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.